First of all, 80s sci-fi is the best sci-fi. Changed my mind. We were actually at the point where it is becoming difficult slash impossible to make a transistor that's any smaller. Give it about 30 seconds and someone will post a clip of another song you may have never heard of that sounds eerily similar to your song. If you feel like every song has been done, then yeah, you're not going to be inspired to pick up songwriting because there's nothing left for you to write. Philosophers. Okay, David, what are we talking about this week? We're going to talk about the limits
of the universe.
Yes.
Whoa.
The limits that there are.
Because they exist.
They're the only ones that arguably really do exist.
Yeah, and I think there's some interesting consequences. Okay, let's pause before we go into it. So I can already hear the naysayers. Limits are just things we don't yet know how to surpass. Nothing's actually limited. Everything's limitless. You just don't know. You just got to know. You just got to discover the way.
Well, first of all, prove that.
It's not my job, man. You got to prove the limit exists.
No, I don't. I can prove that the limit exists based on all current available evidence, and it is your duty to prove in some other way that limit is a false limit.
Like, I think even it doesn't matter ultimately, right? Because I think limits exist. I think most rational people will be like, well, yeah. I do appreciate in some degree the kind of person that's like, we just have imperfect knowledge and there actually might that, you know, science discovers new things all the time. And it's like, that's true. But we've never discovered something unlimited that's provable. We just realized that, oh, the limit's just a little bit bigger than what we thought. Maybe. Like, the one you hear it about all the time with is, like, speed of light, right?
Yeah.
That's like, the limit that everyone's like, that actually may not be a real limit. But we're pretty sure it is actually a real limit. But it would be really convenient if it wasn't, for what most people fantasize about. What does the speed of light stop you from doing?
Going fast.
Which might be important if you are daydreaming about a spacefaring civilization. Even if for no other reason but like being able to communicate, right?
Right. Yeah, communication is a big deal. Yeah.
Like, I think we talked about this.
Because you can actually, because of time dilation, you can travel far distances within a lifetime with actually not that much acceleration.
Right.
Surprisingly little acceleration. But you won't be able to communicate back where you came from.
Yeah, information still moves at the speed of light.
Right. Yeah, if two things are X light years apart, it really is going to take X years to communicate at minimum.
And like we talked about this, we had an episode a while back about like sci-fi, like human civilizations and the stars or something like that. I don't remember the name of the episode.
I don't remember the name either, but yes.
But like, I think the point that we talked about with that was interesting is that like if you were going to go on the spacefaring civilization, you know, road trip and I stayed at Earth or vice versa, you know, by the time you get to space, we can still communicate through video chat. But after a while, like once you kind of get past Mars, it's like email, like text may work.
Text messages, once you get outside the solar system, okay, email seems more appropriate. And then eventually it's just so long that the things we have to say to each other are no longer relevant by the time they arrive.
Right. And so like the method by which you communicate, like I might write you letters like journal entries, but I don't actually expect you to respond to what I'm saying as much. It's more like sending postcards.
Right.
And there will come a point where I will send you the last postcard knowing you will not see it till after I die, probably. And that's a weird thing to think about.
Mm-hmm.
So I get that would be a very convenient limit to not exist because it's unfathomable, really, to...
Yeah, it's beyond our normal comprehension. I mean, it is comprehensible.
Sure, but like the world that would...
But only like in the abstract. It's difficult to actually conceive distances like that.
Right. Like, I always thought that, first of all, 80s sci-fi is the best sci-fi. Changed my mind. But things like Alien, the franchise, Space Truckers, like, I love that visualization because it's like, of course humans would still be drinking coffee in space because coffee's amazing, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the best thing. Yeah.
Yeah. But thinking about, like, trying to comprehend living in a world where you know somebody and you're friends with them and then they get a job and it's like, okay, well, I'm going on this job and I'll just never see you again.
Right. It was nice knowing you. Yeah.
But that's just normal. Like, relationships are just different in that way. That's what to me is unfathomable is, you know, you may have family members that, like, you may be the one going through that time dilating journey and come back and to meet your great, 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 great grand niece or nephew. Right. It's like, oh yeah, I was your ex ancestors ago brother. And he's been dead for hundreds of years, but I'm still alive because I went on a big trip, you know? Like, that's a weird... Family reunions in the time of...
Yes.
Interstellar travel would be very interesting. But yeah, we get back together. Also, like, what calendar you use? Like, is there a concept of universal time?
Well, no.
Well, but hear me out. Like, I guess you can't, I guess, really? Like,
no, you cannot.
Not even knowing how fast you're going, kind of approximate what time it would be back on Earth?
Oh, yeah, yeah, you can do that. Yeah, you could.
Like, that's what I'm saying. Like, imagine, you know, every ship that leaves Earth is set to Earth time.
Yeah, if you know how much you've accelerated, then yes, you could theoretically calculate what time it is back on Earth.
Right, so like, you know, but your experience in that time becomes meaningless because it's like, well, on Earth, it's one-to-one the time we experience now, right? But like, imagine... I'm telling you, like, yeah, you need to go on this interstellar space truck trip. And you go, okay, well, how far is it? Like, I can tell you where it is and how far, how you're going to get there using what vehicle. But you're ultimately going to want to know, like, well, how long is it going to take? It's like, well,
for you,
yeah,
a few years.
But on Earth,
a few 10,000 years.
Right. And... You know, that actually, this is not the point of this episode, but it's going to tangent I kind of want to go on. Time. Relativity. Like, that... Time is convenient.
Pretty weird.
It is weird, but it's also... But, like, conceptually how we think about time. Like, normally when you ask me about time, right? It's like, hey, can you come over and help me do this thing? And you ask me, well, how long is it going to take? Why do you care? Are you asking for your time or our time? Like... I think most people assume our time. Like, that's the whole reason why clocks exist, is so that we can share time. Like, share a concept of time.
Well, yeah. We're all in such close proximity and are moving at such similar speeds that relativistic effects are negligible. Right. So, your time is my time.
Yeah. But, when it really gets down to it, we care probably more about our time. Like, right? Because we experience time passing... For us,
time is linear to us,
right?
In our lived experience, time is linear.
So it's weird to think about a world where everyone has to keep track of two times, their time and home time. And they're not the same because right now they're the same. It's a given, you know, like that stuff like that, I think, is what makes contemplating limits unfathomable beyond actually understanding and comprehending. Usually a very high limit, you know, like the speed limit of light is, I can tell you what it is, but you really conceive what it's like to move that fast.
No. I think maybe the closest thing that I can think of that I can like visualize moving at the speed of light is that the round trip to the moon and back is about 3 seconds at light speed. I can imagine approaching the moon, getting there in a second and a half and then coming right back.
Can you, though? Like, can you fathom the distance from the moon to here?
No. The distance, yeah, that's just a number. Yeah.
Right. And I love how people will think,
but like... I can imagine how it, well, aside from the deadly G-forces of actually doing that, but I can imagine, well, actually, that's true. I also wasn't taking into consideration the relativistic effects of going that fast,
right.
Which is another fun thing. Yeah, it's not like the moon just gets bigger because you're getting closer to it. No. It actually blue shifts and becomes invisible while you're doing that.
Yeah, to you, it's almost like teleporting almost.
Yeah.
Or going through a wormhole, like how most people would imagine it in science fiction. Yeah, it's not like the moon just... It's not like point camera at moon and zoom in really fast. Like, that's not what it's like at all.
Also, actually, here's actually the really, really wacky mind-bending part of that, the relativistic effects. Not even the blue shifting and it becomes invisible. If you actually go light speed, which is impossible, but if you were to
99.99 whatever.
Sure, okay, yeah. As an arbitrary number of nines percent the speed
of
light.
As close as you can get, yeah.
Time will also go almost infinitely fast.
Right. For you?
Yes.
Is it your age?
No. The universe around you will age. That's right. The weird part. Yes. So actually, depending on how fast you go to the moon, if you can go to the moon arbitrarily fast, the moon might actually not even be there anymore by the time you get there. The moon will have been destroyed.
Well, okay, but
by the time you get there, because because time around you moved so fast.
But you're only moving a small distance. Like, so you're saying that you can actually move fast enough.
Well, yeah, but if you actually go the speed of light, then time moves infinitely fast and the entire universe is over in an instant.
Right.
So anywhere arbitrarily close to that gets arbitrarily close to the entire universe ending.
That is a weird thing to think about, because I think the other thing most of us would have thought is that, like, if you can start to understand that, like, the universe will speed up relative to you because you're moving so fast, most mm-hmm. people can understand that, but they would assume that it's, like, linear between, like, I'm moving a fixed distance, right? So if I move at Earth-like speeds, which, again, I know that's, you know, but if I move there and back and it takes me, you know, 10 days to get to the moon and back, right? And when I get back, 10 days have passed. The assumption that I think most people would have is that if you travel there in 2 seconds, 10 days would still pass for you to get there and back for everything but you, right? Regardless of how fast you get there.
Well, yes, and if it's still, to everyone looking at you, it still takes you 3 seconds to go there and back.
Right.
So, I guess the place where this breaks down is that, like, this requires, like, infinite acceleration as well.
Sure.
To even do that.
But assuming that you accelerate to half the speed of light by the halfway point, and then you decelerate, and then you accelerate and then decelerate back, right?
Right.
Because you want to be able to see the moon. The point is not to go to the moon and back and be like, want to see me do it again. Like, I would have thought that you want to take the 1.5 seconds to the moon, look at it for an instant, and then take a 1.5 second trip back.
Yeah.
Right? So you can't instantly accelerate and then instantly decelerate, instantly accelerate, instantly decelerate again, right?
Right.
But assume that you accelerate up to half.
Okay, up to half, like, and then okay, so yeah, so now those effects are not going to add up the same way. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. So to everyone, well, and actually, the trip is shorter for you.
Right,
you will not feel like it took a second and a half to get there. It'll be less than that.
Yeah.
Everyone else will agree that it took you 3 seconds for the round trip.
Well, let's put it again. This is the time thing. 3 seconds for. Who?
Someone standing on Earth watching you.
Mm. What about 3 seconds for me? I want to get there in a second and a half and come back in a second and a half. How does that look to the person on Earth?
You'll be going slower to them. It'll take you longer to them.
Right. So what's the point? Right? That's the weird thing. Like, imagine, like, I think, like, here's the problem statement. Oh, there is we found this special thing on the moon that we need on Earth desperately.
Mm-hmm.
What's the fastest we can get it here? If we have to go get it and come back with it. And on Earth, the assumption would be like, oh, well, I would take a plane straight to my destination, get the thing, get back on the plane and fly straight back, right? Because that's faster than driving all the way there, like at a lower rate of speed, right? But what is the actual fastest you can go retrieve the thing and bring it back to the people on Earth?
3 seconds. Well, aside from the other losses in time that it takes to,
I mean, assuming
disembark and get the thing and load it.
I guess, but like
the theoretical fastest time to Earth is
approximately
the light distance times two.
Yeah, so 3 seconds. And then, but for you, how quickly can you go get it and come back? Like when you return to Earth.
Instantaneously, if you had infinite acceleration.
Right. And that's the weird thing. So this is just the moon to Earth, right? Going across the stars and back would be even more interesting to think about. But that's the, I guess that's the thing is what makes it weird is that, like, how long is it going to take us to go get there, get it, and come back? Well, you can't just use your perception of time to know, right? Like, and that's, I think that's the big breaking difference that right now, if I get on a plane, fly to Hong Kong and come back, right, as an example, I know how long I've been gone because it's the same time. We're sharing time for the most part. Even though, even in that example, I did actually spend less time traveling than I was gone. That's the really weird part, I think.
Well, yeah. Well, because there's also spatial compression that happens, which is why from your frame of reference, you don't break light speed.
Right.
Right. Light still goes the speed of light from your frame of reference as well. But as you accelerate closer and closer to the speed of light, the moon gets closer to you because the space between you compresses.
Weird. Anyway.
And then when you slow down, it gets farther away again.
Right. So, yeah, limits are weird. But that's like...
That's not exactly what we wanted to talk about.
No, we want to talk about...
The topic of this was not about going the speed of light.
No. And in fact, I think we wanted to talk about, I think, more human conceivable limits.
Let's do something in between first.
Okay.
Limits of technology.
Okay.
So, Moore's Law.
Okay.
For those who don't know Moore's Law, it states that every, I think it's 7 years, computing power doubles by some metric.
Moore's Law is the observation that the number of transistors on an integrated circuit doubles about every 2 years.
2 years, okay.
Yep.
Okay. Number of transistors on an integrated circuit. Okay, that could theoretically still work, but our integrated circuits would have to get bigger and bigger to make that true now.
Well, I think it depends, right? What is an integrated circuit, I'm assuming, of the same size, right? So there would still be a limit.
Right. So anyway, the point is we were actually at the point where it is becoming difficult / impossible to make a transistor that's any smaller. I don't know that this is absolutely a physical limit, but right now it is a practical limit. That if you make a transistor any smaller, that you end up with weird quantum mechanical effects, making it not work as a transistor, even if it is structurally the same but smaller. The gating action of a transistor doesn't work. Maybe theoretically there's some way around that, but I don't know what it is. And apparently engineers don't either because they haven't done it.
Right. Like, do you know what the smallest transistors we have right now are?
They're a few nanometers across.
Less.
Less than nanometers?
Yes.
Okay.
Fractional nanometers across.
Okay. So picometers?
Well, they're still doing it. It's 0.34 nanometers.
Okay, so 340 picometers.
To put that in context, because pico and nanometers don't mean anything to most people.
Do.
Well, not to most people. And the thing I'm about to equivalent it to also won't make any sense.
So a nanometer is a billionth of a meter, right?
Yes.
So a picometer is a trillionth of a meter. So 340 trillionths of a meter.
Right. Now, these are lab tested, right? Mm-hmm. But they are...
Yeah, the most ideal circumstances, yeah.
And they're roughly the width of a carbon atom. Which means you have to use atoms smaller than carbon to make them, obviously.
Right.
Which is what's difficult, you know. Now...
Okay, these are not silicon then.
No.
Yeah.
Well, okay. I said no bigger than a carbon atom. In which direction, right? They're no thicker than a carbon atom. They are silicon. Silicon's bigger than carbon, isn't it?
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's a bigger atomic number, but I don't know what its actual atomic size is, because those don't necessarily correlate.
That's true. Well, these are made from graphene, so they are one...
graphene is carbon.
Right. So it says no thicker than. So it's a single layer of carbon in one direction.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Either way, not that most people can conceive of how small a carbon atom is anyway.
No, it's incomprehensibly small as well.
But
yeah.
But the point is it's pretty small, but it's not actually that much smaller than what you can commercially buy right now. I guess it depends on your concept of size, but like 7-nanometer chips are available now. You can buy them in stores.
Right. So that would be like 20 times bigger than that.
Right.
Than the smallest one.
But comparing that to like transistors we were dealing with only 40 years ago, that's way bigger than 20 times bigger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we're talking about like the vacuum tube transistors, that's millions of times bigger, tens of thousands of times bigger. See, the scales are...
I mean, yeah, they're macroscopic.
Yeah, you can actually see them as opposed to...
You can see the parts of them. They're so huge, you can look through a wall of glass and see the parts.
Right. Whereas these, you actually cannot use...
Even silicon transistors, the first ones, you couldn't do that.
Right. And they're not made by machines in the way of what you normally think. They're not actually being assembled. They're being flashed. We're using light to make these.
Right, like etching them into a wafer.
Yeah, we're using lenses and stuff to make a physical thing.
Right, because, yeah, machines that move, like mechanical arms and stuff like that, are not precise enough to make something that small.
Exactly.
We have to focus light in a way to get... We need lasers. We need lasers for that kind of precision. Yeah.
Yeah, so... But like you said, we're getting to the point where now... You know, we made those big leaps from I can hold one in my hand to I can't touch them or see them. They're so small.
Right.
To
if you touch them, you will destroy them immediately. If you touch the wafer, you will destroy millions, maybe billions of transistors.
Exactly. But then we're jumping from that just to a little bit smaller, and that's a big deal, right? And the IEEE article I'm looking at, and this is why I know it's a good source, because that I was a little skeptical about that, but it's an IEEE article.
IEEE is legit, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, even they're talking about how this is probably about as small as we can get.
So that's interesting that I think that's the first human relevant limit that we can think about is limits of technology like this, where it's like, technology actually is not going to get much better than it is now.
Right.
It will get better. And well, okay. It cannot get better in that way. It cannot get better in terms of transistor density. And there will be other limits that we find as well.
Can we please take a tangent so I can tell you about something I just read in this article?
Okay.
Its effective width is only 0.34 nanometers. Do you know why?
Why?
It changes sizes when it's on because it's so small that the electric force put on it will actually cause it to
expand
up to 0.34 nanometers, but it will actually shrink when it's not in use.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's insane.
Yeah, think about that. Yeah. Anyway, please continue.
Yeah. So anyway, the thing is, yeah. So the point of this episode is to think about the implications in human life and philosophy for physical limits. So the first one of these, the technological limit, it's like, okay, computer technology is not going to get much better than it is now.
No.
Which is interesting and maybe a little bit concerning to think about.
Right. And like, we may come up with ways to use the same technology in a more efficient way, and that's kind of where we're going. You know, the emphasis in, which is kind of funny because that's how it started, right? The assumption a long time ago is that this computer, the size of a room, it's so expensive that it's actually cheaper to pay smart people to crunch all day on a simple problem like, how can we find spelling errors faster? than to just brute force the thing faster. And so there was a culture in software of being very efficient.
Well, I mean, old computers used to be run on a timeshare system. You literally paid for how much computer time you used. So writing more efficient code was noticeably cheaper, immediately cheaper, because you could get more done in the time that you paid for.
Mm-hmm.
Or pay for less time.
But the culture around that shifted from once memory became cheap, once transistors became cheap, memory's cheap, processing's cheap, just buy a better processor, slap it in there. We just need to be doing more things, right? So the focus, instead of let's do these handful of things which computers are good at as efficiently as possible, to let's make computers do things that we would have never thought they would have been able to do, i.e. things like scaling that up to things like putting computers as essentially cashiers in stores, self-checkout.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to someone in 1965 and telling them, yeah, we're going to use these to cash people out at the grocery store, they would have laughed you out of the room. Like, just inconceivable. Because why would you ever do that? Like, it's so much cheaper to employ a person, mm-hmm. you know? To now, it's like, well, I mean, this thing is really, really good at doing all kinds of neat things. Like, the computers at your self-checkout could be folding, you know, folding proteins in a lab somewhere, like, running simulations to do that. But instead, they're brainlessly cat making change, you know?
Right.
But now we're kind of going back to, well, now that we're kind of at the limits of what
we can
do.
Now that we can't rely on electrical engineers to just give us better, faster computers
that are cheaper,
that we can throw our inefficient code at and it just works.
Yeah.
On time scales that we can work with.
Right.
To, okay, well, I guess we have to start being efficient again, because that's the only way we're going to get more performance out of this.
And we're building more specific hardware again. That's something that we did not see for a long time.
Right, application-specific hardware, yeah.
Yeah, like for the longest time, and anyone who deals with computers knows about this. Like, if you know that your computer has a CPU, the brain, that's how it's always talked about. Mm-hmm. Well, for graphics, you need a GPU. But now there's others. Have you heard of the other PUs that exist?
I mean, yeah.
LPUs? Heard of those?
LPU.
Logical processing units.
Well, that's what a CPU is.
No. So let's see. Logical processing units are.
Is that for like branching?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Doing branch math and stuff like that. Branch traversal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's what it's for. Which is, again, yes, technically you're not wrong. That's kind of what CPUs do. But that's all these
but
do.
But it's optimized specifically for branch.
That's all it does.
Branching code, yeah.
Yep. Graphics processing units, you've heard before. They're making specific units for quant QPUs, or the next one that everyone's talking about, quantum processing units.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, that's a little bit of woo-woo science, kind of. But
it's still kind of woo-woo right now. I don't know if that's ever really going to turn into a thing. We'll see.
But now that like AI is a thing, there's things that are GPUs were used for this for a long time, but they're actually now building specific hardware for modeling in that way, like AI modeling. But the fact is that we're branching out for the first time in a long time.
Right. We've run up into the limits of what a CPU can do. So we're making application specific hardware for the other things that would have been done by a CPU, but could be done faster if we engineered a circuit just to do that thing.
Yeah. So instead of how can I make this general thing faster to do the thing that I'm asking it to do faster, how can I just build something purpose-built specifically to do the thing that I want? And again, that's something we saw a long time ago, like back when computers actually shipped with graphics cards, for example. Or not graphical processors, like sound cards.
Mm-hmm.
This is dedicated hardware to make your headphones sound good because it was unreasonable to ask a CPU to do that, you know.
Well, the original sound cards existed because we didn't have PCM audio yet. So the original sound card was literally like a synthesizer chip on a circuit board, and the CPU could send commands for what sounds that the synth should make. And then that just has an audio output on it. And then, yeah, eventually we got to PCM audio, which is just digital sampled audio, which a CPU could do. It's just feeding the sample straight through it, and then it goes through a circuit to convert that to an analog signal because audio is analog. Yeah. And sound cards do still exist. Your computer does still have a sound card. It's just part of the motherboard now.
Yeah.
Because we decided every computer needs that.
Sounds important. But yeah, so that's another example of how us hitting up physical limit is changing the way, and I know that this, the change in culture affects those working on these things more so maybe, but there's other interesting things to think about that I think is similar to this. So good example, I think, interfaces between machines, right? For a long time, there have been a lot of, for a long time, there have been many different interfaces that do many different things in different ways, right?
Mm-hmm.
But most people are familiar with things like the USB protocol or USB. You know, I think anybody listening to this probably knows what USB means, or at least they have an idea about
the port. I think most people don't know what USB means, but they
know what it
are familiar with using USB devices. Yeah.
Right. If I said plug this into the USB port,
they'd be able to find it.
Yes. Yeah. But there will come a time, like, I guess most people think about this, there is a perfect port. I guess, technically. There is an ideal way to make a port that would be good enough that why don't we just use it for everything? And USB, i.e. the name being universal, kind of was...
USB would like to be that.
It would like to be that.
And it did do that for a lot of them. It did... For all of the interfaces that essentially boiled down to some serial data, or just some digital data passing through,
mm-hmm.
That would be driven by your computer, USB made all of those converge into one connector.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't need a separate connector type for your mouse and your keyboard and your joystick and your speakers or whatever.
And USB has been around, for the record, since 1996.
Yeah.
Okay. But since that idea came about with, why don't we just have a thing that does all the things, or good enough for most things to do serial, right? Even it has changed. Most people, for example, which USB port are they talking about? If I said look for the
USB port. It's USB type A. Yeah.
A?
For the USB port?
Yeah.
Yeah, type A.
I thought type A was the square one.
Type A is the square one.
No, not the rectangular one, the square one.
Oh, the rectangular one is type A.
Oh, I thought that was type B.
Type B is square.
Okay, well, then never mind. Yeah, type A. But so most people don't know about type B, I guess, unless you've plugged in probably a printer at some point.
Mostly printers use it, yeah, because it's big. Well, it's square, which is unwieldy for a lot of small devices.
Right.
Yeah, then there's the mini B,
which
is B, but mini. And then there's the micro B, which is B, but pointy.
Has teeth on it, too.
It does. That's what I meant. And then now we have USB type C.
Which is reversible.
Which is reversible and goes both ways.
And captures the spirit of what USB-A probably was trying to do, which is use me for everything.
Well, it wasn't. USB, the thing that separated USB from other things is that it was a host-guest paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The computer is the host and all of the peripherals you're plugging in are guests. That is baked into the USB protocol. Are you a host or a guest? And it was a special thing when they came out with the USB on-the-go standard, which allowed for things to be both guests and hosts, depending on the context.
Right. But I think the point...
But now everything is a computer.
Yes.
So the notion of host and guest, that line has gotten blurrier and blurrier.
To the point
where it's like, yeah. Okay, everything can just use the same port.
Yep.
And we'll figure it out in software.
Yep. I think the point I'm trying to get at, though, is that there will come a time when there is a good enough port for the vast majority of applications that I do think we will essentially all come to agree on one port. It is convenient. It's grabby enough for our fat human hands to get a hold of. It's easy to insert enough. It's resilient enough to last for a long time. And the data throughput is high enough. Data/power throughput, shockingly, is high enough that because we've hit the limits of what hardware we're even going to be connecting, there's no point in ever changing it, you know? And like, I think it's funny to think about how, like, right now, those of you out there, imagine your grandma's computer, okay? And she says, my mouse broke. It would not be that surprising, I think, to a lot of people these days to go to her computer and find that it has an SPI plug for the mouse. Maybe.
SPI?
Not SPI. PSP.
PS2?
PS2. That's it. Sorry. PlayStation Portable. Like a PS2, which most people may be like, what is that? That's one of those barrel plugs that has a bunch of pins in it. Looks old.
It's a even another old term. It's a DIN type plug.
Old. Yeah. It don't look like the new plugs.
Yes.
It's got holes and pointy bits, but not the like USB micro pointy bits, but it's different. Anyway, not important. But there's going to come a time when it's just a foregone conclusion that these will all use the same thing. But that doesn't gel with how I think we think about civilization timescales. For example, it's right now, if we were to think about a civilization 1,000 years ago, we don't even think we would be able to communicate with them, even though they're human.
Mm-hmm.
And even though, like, for example, French 1,000 years ago would not sound like French today, probably.
Right.
Could a French speaker today talk to a French speaker 1,000 years ago? Maybe.
But I mean, easier than they could talk to like a Chinese person today.
Right.
But yeah, it's there. It would be a challenge. They would have to learn each other's language. Yeah.
But imagine being where we might be in about 100 years or so. We're not making predictions about the future on the show, but that's not the point. But imagine we do land on that universal port in about 100 years. And then 1,000 years from that, someone discovers an abandoned computer on some planet somewhere and goes, huh, let me plug into it and see if I can extract the data. And that's just okay.
And it's possible because the standard hasn't changed since then. Or it's backwards compatible at least.
Right, because why would you need to change it? You're operating against a physical limit now. Why would you need to change it? You can't get more efficient. Or you can't get more efficient with the other trade-offs being assumed, right? Mm-hmm. And I think this is particularly possible because where are we going to go after plugs? Because we're going to get to the point where things just won't have plugs on them, probably. Like, we're going to use inductive charging for everything. And plugs are one of the hardest things about designing an electronic because that's a hole. That's how things get in there, like water and such, that destroy it. You know how resilient a cell phone could be if there was no holes in it?
Mm-hmm.
It just vibrated the glass to your ear to make the sound go through. You vibrated it back to speak into it. You inductively charge it. It Bluetooths to everything. If you could get rid of the holes, it'd be the perfect phone. But I think the only reason why we would always have a plug option is for some things that fail, right? But once 90% of the things that two pieces of electronics are doing is all wireless, then that removes the incentive even more for ever changing the standard because you're only using it in niche cases anyway. So I do think that instance could very easily
happen. It becomes the wire standard. Yeah.
Yeah. The wire. It's just used. Well, you may have like two or three different kinds. Like here's like, no, you have the wire standard and then industrial and like commercial specific things that are like for like power transmission, stuff like that, where you're really, there's no such thing as, I don't think, a connector for power lines. You put the wire in and then you just crank it down onto the contact, right? Like if you go to a substation, the wires coming off the power lines do not plug into anything.
There's no socket for
that.
There's
no receptacle. Yeah, it's just, well, actually there is a receptacle by definition, but there's no socket.
It's not a socket. It's like a binding post. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You're just tying them together because it's dangerous, but no one should be in here anyway. So good enough. Yeah. You'll have that kind of stuff going on and then like the wire standard for data. And it's just funny to me to think about, oh, this is a 1,000-year-old computer. I wonder if it still boots. Plugs into it. Like, that's the kind of thing that I imagine if you put it in a movie, there'd be some neckbeard being like, really?
After you think the power socket's going to be the same? But
actually, yes.
Actually, yes, though.
Yeah. Fascinating.
Yeah. Or maybe I could still see the case for there being like two wire standards. Which is the reason that we use different cables for networking than we do for computer peripherals.
Mm-hmm.
Network cables are good at carrying a signal for long distances that USB cannot.
Right. But who knows? Maybe we will consolidate them eventually. Who knows?
I mean, yeah. You can do USB protocol over Ethernet cable.
Yeah.
That's a thing you can do, but nobody does do it.
Right. But what about other limits? because there was one that we originally talked about that got us onto this topic that we have not even approached yet.
No. Limits of creativity. Ain't that something?
Yeah. Now, before anyone out there complains, especially if you feel like you're a special creative snowflake, you're not. It's okay. Calm down. Breathe. Just don't type fast at us just yet. But we're currently living in a phenomena that is kind of unique, I think, to our time. Not the phenomena, but the transitioning from the prior state of affairs to the next state of affairs. Let's pick on a cultural thing like music.
Sure.
For the vast majority of human history, if you wanted to hear music, how did you do it?
You had to be in the same room as the musicians.
Yes. You had to listen to it live. And that was it. That was the only option. But what if you wanted to share that music with someone who lived in a different place? Well, either they have to travel to you to listen to the music too, or the musicians have to travel to them. Well, how did the musicians make sure that they performed it the same way both times? Well, sheet music. So we wrote it down.
We found a way to write down instructions for playing music. Yeah.
Yeah. And before then, there's actually no way to guarantee that the song didn't change, which I'm certain it did.
Oh, sure. I mean, if you watch any music, even today, if you watch musicians who are like in the process of making a song, and they'll be like, okay, let's do it again from the top, but they'll play it differently the next time. Cause they'll, unless they're really trying to do it the same way, but they'll find some way to change it that they think sounds better.
But even after they've like recorded it and said, yep, this is the version that I want to put out on the record,
you'll go listen to them live and it'll be a little bit different. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's down to the point where if you like a musician enough and you've got all their CDs or all of their copies, like you and I have commented about this about Billy Joel before, because he's re-recorded a bunch of songs a bunch of times. I have particular recordings that I like
right,
best.
I like this song from this album release. Yeah,
exactly. Because he changed it. And why wouldn't he? He's creative. He maybe got
tired
of it.
And he's played it 1,000 times.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the thing to think about. He's played it 1,000 times.
He's bored of whatever he did in the studio then.
Yeah.
So he's moved on to something else. But he's still expected to play that song though.
Exactly. So it's got to be that song is what I wanted to hear. But he's going to put his own spin on it live. And you're going to be happy about it because you're seeing him live.
Well, and also, yeah, you came to see him live. If you wanted to listen to it just the way it was in the studio, you could just listen to the record.
Right. But before we wrote things down, you didn't actually know, but say you're a composer and you want to write a song before things can write it down, your experience for what music should sound like can only come from, firsthand at least, what music you've heard.
Right.
So within the span of a human lifetime, even if you're living in a place that has a lot of music, there's so many variations you can put in that it's pretty easy to make something that doesn't sound like everybody else's stuff. But fast forward to now, where for the past over 100 years now, we've been recording
over 100, yeah. Barely,
but just now over 100 years, anything could have been recorded. Now, not everything was. But anything that wasn't able to be recorded maybe has sheet music that's older, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're...
Well, yeah, and a lot of this stuff with sheet music that wasn't recorded originally has been performed by orchestras and bands today.
Yes.
And recorded.
Yes. So let's put it in the paradigm. So walk into a record store or a place where there's a music snob. Or go to the internet, you'll find one. And make a song that you think, like, lock yourself in a room and write a simple song that's like 30 seconds long or a riff or whatever. And then put it on the internet and say, I wrote a new song that's totally new and creative and unique. Give it about 30 seconds and someone will post a clip of another song you may have never heard of that sounds eerily similar to your song.
I mean, sometimes it's hard to come up with an original sound from things that you've even heard before. There was a fun sketch I saw. So there's a YouTube
piano playing guy.
Yes.
Makes funny faces. Yeah, yes. I know you're talking about.
Daniel Thrasher is his name.
What a great name.
It is a pretty great name, actually. And he has done multiple now about when you're trying to be original, but you keep playing songs that you've heard before.
Yeah. Just slowed down, sped up, different key, you know.
Right, but all it takes is somebody else that's very observant about that to point out, be like, no, that's just that song, but in a different key. Or that's just that song, but sped up. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, which came first, Panama or Jump? They're the same song, actually. Doesn't matter. But it's just an example. So now we're living in a time where we actually have a memory. Our collective memory actually goes back further now, much more so than it used to. And so for a long time, it would have been fairly easy to think of yourself as creative because the neckbeard that knows all the songs isn't in the room. Like, it's very unlikely that you'll find that person that told you, well, that's not creative. Or that's not original.
Original, because there's a difference between creativity and originality.
Yes. Exactly. Like, don't get me wrong. Don't let anyone rob you of the fact that you came up with this yourself. But if you really think about it, how did you, you know, did you though? Like, how much of that's borrowed from things you may have heard before?
Fun fact, it's all borrowed.
Yeah. Or it's an accident. Which, how you can't know that if it's an accident.
Right, but even
or
then, like, but like the way that musicians come up with things accidentally is by borrowing something and then just making an alteration to it.
And then just iterate on that alteration until it becomes sufficiently different enough that you can show it to a new person and they don't tie it back to the
original. Immediately recognize it as something they've heard before.
Was it you who was telling me about there's like this famous con artist that pretty much devolved all songs down to like 6 or 7 basic songs?
No.
Is that not you?
No, I don't guess so. Or I forgot.
I hope I didn't hallucinate this at one point. I don't know. I'll have to look it up. This may be wrong. But I'm trying to remember who came up with that. It doesn't surprise me. But whether or not the story is true or not, I do find it realistic to think that there was a guy who sat down who just really liked listening to music and can actually kind of map how the song changed over time. Like, yes, well, this little ditty appeared in a folk song dating back to 1200 BC. But if you take it and you repeat it and you add this in the middle, you actually get, or it shows up in this orchestral piece as like a, you know, like a litany that goes through, right? But then you take that and you make it played by this instrument and you speed it up and you change the key. You know, if you're listening to each slice,
like kind of like etymology.
Yeah. If you listen to it slice by slice, you can totally hear the same. But if you play the most recent version and the original, it would sound totally different.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I do not doubt that that's a thing that someone has probably sat down and done, at least for some song or some series.
Yeah,
you of
certainly
songs.
Could not do it for everything. There's too much stuff.
Well, but there's limited stuff. You could
True.
Do it.
There is
time.
A finite amount of music. Yeah.
Yeah. And I question, like, and this is where we wanted to get to when it comes to the impact on the culture. I think more so now than ever, we are aware of the lack of originality because we remember now collectively through, you know,
through recordings.
We remember. And so, but how does the realization of the lack of originality affect creativity, right? Because I think most people would get really upset when they're told they're not being original, because no one would say it that way. They would say you're not being creative, because the goal, I think, of most creative people is to make something that is original.
Well, I think, I don't know that I would say that the goal of creative people is to make something original. I think that there is just okay, if someone can immediately recognize the thing that you thought you did that was creative, if they can recognize it as something else they've heard before, then it cheapens what you've done because there's a stigma against copying other people, right? Because copying somebody else is not creative. That is decidedly not creative to just copy somebody else's stuff. Like if I literally just play somebody else's song with no alterations to it whatsoever, that is not creative. It is performative, maybe, and it could still be impressive if it's a difficult song to play. But it's not creative. Most cover songs at least try to be different in some way so that they still seem creative. They might change the instrumentation a little bit or maybe change some lyrics or something like that. But yeah, copying is decidedly not creative. So if you get told that your new song sounds exactly like some other song, then you're basically being told that, yeah, that you're not creative because you did what somebody else already did.
Yeah. But I think that feeling in general is enough to maybe dissuade people who otherwise might attempt to be creative to say, what's the point, you know?
Yeah, if you really feel like every song has been done, then yeah, you're not going to be inspired to pick up songwriting because, well, there's nothing left for you to write.
Right. And this is not just unique to music or creativity in this way, but innovation in general, which innovation I think is just a name we came up with to make sure that we said we want to be creative, but about things that actually matter and are productive to humanity.
Again, you mean invention? Because that's different.
Is it? What is an invention?
An invention is an original idea for a machine.
Okay.
Innovation is adapting old technologies.
Mm.
Or repurposing old technologies.
Well, okay, that's fair.
Or making an iteration on an old technology. That's innovation.
Right. But the thing at the point I'm trying to get at is that the process of innovation is very, very similar to the process of creativity for, you know.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, I think it's a worthwhile endeavor because every now and again we do make a real innovation or someone does come up with something that's creative enough. And I think the best way to think about it is that things being made for their time, right? Like there are probably plenty of songs or pieces of art or inventions or innovations that could have been made before, but because we were not in a place as a people for it, it didn't matter. Like people probably wrote songs like they wrote during the Vietnam War in the United States that didn't get popular or become staples of an era because we weren't in the Vietnam War. It didn't matter. Like that song, I've listened to before, like, you know, like CCR, like
Fortunate Son.
Yes. That song, imagine that song coming out and being popular in a different context.
Right. That is the Vietnam War song. Yeah.
You know, but we've done things that are talked about like that before, but we didn't feel the same way about it, you know, collectively, or the attitude of a large group of people anyway, wasn't that way about it. You know, we did a lot of the same things during the Vietnam War that we did during the Second World War and the Korean War even. But it wasn't until the Vietnam War that the populace was like, we are in a place where we need to hear something like this. We want to amplify this. This just feels like our time. And it was a product of its time. Even though I guarantee you there's probably some artist out there that was like, you know, I wrote Fortunate Son pretty much. My song was just like that. It just came out too soon. And that's maybe true.
It was probably Bob Dylan.
Probably, no, it was probably Joan Baez because he stole everything from her anyway. But exactly, though. Like, I imagine, like, von Neumann architecture for computers, right? He had ideas about how computers could be used and built long before we had the capability of actually making them work that way, really, you know? People probably had innovations like, you know, it'd be really cool if we could get transistors down to be, like, microscopic. And everyone's like, shut up, nerd. Put the tube in. Like, you think computers are ever going to get that small? You know, I don't know. Like, smokeless powder, for example, existed before, and in a totally different application before it was used in firearms is another example. Like there are tons of innovations that came about, but there was no purpose for it or no one could think of a purpose for it until later. I think one of my favorite ones is MRI machines.
Mm.
MRI machines came about because some scientist was trying to figure out what stars were out there. And he discovered that, oh, things magnetically resonate. And you can see it. That's pretty cool. And these gigantic things very, very far away have been resonating for a long time at a certain frequency. So if I can capture those resonations, I can tell them apart. And someone came along and was like, wait, everything resonates? He's like, yeah.
What about a person?
What about tiny things like inside of people? Well, I guess. Hmm. That'd be cool.
What if we just invert this telescope inside out?
Turn it into
and
a microscope.
At a person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then look inside a person. Yeah, exactly. And so, but I think even then, like, it's weird to think that there's probably going to come a time where, but for any given task or purpose, there's probably some peak efficient way to do it. Or it's so good that the gains you would get to, like, by investing in trying to be better are just no longer worth it. Right. And that's an interesting place to be, you know. I know we started this talking about software and we're getting close to time, but I think one of the most interesting things about people using like AI and software is seeing the very efficient things that it comes up with sometimes that are very clever, that if you wrote code like that in a professional setting would get you fired, because it's code that's not reusable. It's not portable. It's meant to do exactly what it's doing right here, right now.
Yeah.
You know, but it's very efficient at it for this specific purpose. But that's not how we were taught to write things early on. You know, like, have you ever looked at like old assembly code that does like really jankety stuff where it's like, man, that's unsafe. It's like, well, that's fine though, but it works and it will never break because of how it's implemented here. But if you took this one function out, which not, if you took this one subroutine out,
mm-hmm.
that's what it would actually be.
Yes.
And put it in some other application, it would break because it's contextual, you know?
Right. It's handcrafted for the application.
Exactly. Yeah. But once you start doing that again, you will get to a point where it's like, you can't really, you can handcraft hardware for things. You can handcraft the software for it. But once you start doing things like that, there kind of comes a time when it's like, this is just as efficient as it's going to get, pretty much, or mathematically about as fast as we can do this.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's no point to ever rewrite it again for this one particular purpose. And there's also limits to the things that we need done. That's another weird thing to think about. You know, there's a limit to the things that you can experience in your lifetime. There's a limit to the things that you need and the speed that you can be provided them or the cost that they can bear, you know? And that would be an interesting thing to think about too, is a society in which everything is produced as economically as efficient as possible, which we're not even close to, by the way. But what is the true cost, like, of labor? Like, if everyone actually did put in equal labor for equal output, how much labor would you actually need to put in for it, for you to get enough to live off of as output, you know? And that's a weird world to think about. That's a good thing to think about, I think, you know? I would love to live in a world where, you know, one man sitting at a desk can generate enough food for every living person on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Through his efforts, because everything else has been just fine-tuned and made so efficient that one man's decisions or one woman's decisions can just food for everyone, you know, just 1 8-hour day of his time, you know, every day, you know. That's a hyperbole, maybe, I don't know, you know. And you don't, and that's kind of also crazy to think about, is that you don't need AI to get there, actually, I don't think, for some things like that.
Mm-hmm.
The AI may be able to get there a lot faster because it can it can iterate itself into these weird, very context-specific things that we normally don't think about. But I think that also informs the culture. Imagine having a culture where you're thought to, where it is actually advantageous to not think about things in a general way. Like, it's actually, you know, because right now we're taught abstractions, right? You know, when you go to school, your math is an abstraction.
Right, it's a tool.
It's a tool. And we teach.
But what if I need a really specific tool? Yeah.
And what if that's what we need people doing most of the time?
Right. Instead of building general tools like hammers and screwdrivers, application specific tools.
But how do you make a school that cranks out self-forming application specific things?
You need to go even more abstract than the tools we're talking about now.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that I actually kind of like
down to the mechanics. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of an interesting thing to think about, is a culture in which everyone thinks about everything contextually, not as a, well, as a general rule, this is what you don't do. It's like, well, in a world where everyone's building,
or in terms of common pieces,
but when no one's building common pieces anymore,
right.
What's the point in learning it that way?
Right. Well, it's useless. Yeah. You actually just need to understand the mechanics of the thing.
Yeah.
You need to have an intuition for the underlying mechanics.
But how does that affect us in a way when we do need to be able to commonly communicate as people? We still need to be able to, like, have assumptions about each other that I can't have your context.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, something that's very interesting. I think it'd be very interesting to see people go local again, because it's easier to share a context, right? Where you actually talk more to the people in your area, not because everyone's so similar, but because it's like we think about things so contextually that it's just more comfortable to talk to people that have overlaps in your context.
Maybe. I don't know. I feel like that might be assuming that these things bleed over into everyday life more than they really would.
Maybe. But I also think that people think a lot more. But we did that when we went to abstraction, right? I mean, when you're day in, day out, you were raised on a farm because that's your family were serfs, and you think about everything in terms of your serfdom, like your whole upbringing was in that. I mean, I think that there are people that are like that were like that, and I think there are even people that are pretty close to like that now, and we look at them very negatively because they're closed-minded. That's I think the word we would use for them is that, oh, you're just so closed-minded. You're uncultured. You can't see beyond your farm, and it's like, you're right. Why would I need to? You know? But if we don't need to generate a workforce that can be applicable in multiple scenarios anymore, why would we still teach people in the abstraction like that, you know? I'm not saying we will, because I think that there is value. And like you said, you have to go even more abstract to get to the point where you can teach people to be contextual. But if you look at the life cycle of, like, people who have, like, went to college but then, like, moved back home, like, they got their bit of culture, but then everything gets condensed back into, you know, like, a very contextual way of looking at things, and they go back to being very conservative about the way that they live, you know, and they're not, and they don't need to think abstractly about things anymore as much anyway, because they don't see problems that aren't their daily problems as their problems, you know? And I think that's an interesting thing, you know. And I think a combating force to that would obviously be like our interconnectedness, like the internet.
Mm-hmm.
That obviously would fight against it because, you know, especially the sooner you get on it. I just think it'd be interesting because it's a new cultural driver. It's pushing people back towards that to think that way. And I think there are very interesting things to consider when it comes to like how populations are educated affects the culture of that population after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
And that might even be a good episode to just talk about in general sometime, you know, because, you know, maybe a precursor to that is like, well, why are the Germans so industrious? Like, what about their culture makes them make machines the way they do? Because most people don't, other cultures do not produce machinery the way they do. But the Swiss kind of do, but they're also kind of German, you know? Why is that, you know? Japanese technology, like electronics, there's just something about them that were just different and just better than things you could get in other places, right? You know? Mm-hmm. I think that might be an interesting topic to go into. But we are, speaking of limits, coming up on ours for this episode.
Indeed.
So, do you have any other things you want to say about that? I think this was a good episode.
No. I think I'm satisfied with that.
Well, until next time, philosophers.
Philosophers.
If you like the music in this episode, please check out Jippy on Bandcamp at jippy.bandcamp.com.
Philosophers is supported by viewers like you.
If there's a topic you'd like us to discuss,
or a topic you'd like to see revisited in the future,
please let us know by contacting us using the methods in the description,
or in the comments below. Thank you for listening.